Kinetic MCs, Glenn Waco, Pale Soul, Flowmatic, Diction, Destro, Gums, Soul Miner, and many more. February 27th, 2015 at the Hawthorne Theater, Northwest Hip Hop Fest 4. Starts at 9 p.m. and is 21 and up.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
So I'm Mateo Hoke, and I'm the co-editor of Palestine Speaks, Narratives of Life Under Occupation, which is a collection of oral history narratives from the West Bank and Gaza, people whose lives are impacted by the Israeli military occupation in the Palestinian territories. So the book got started when my writing partner, my longtime writing partner, Kate Malik, moved to the West Bank to work for an NGO. And the NGO she was working with did walking tours around the West Bank. And so she had connections to some pretty marginalized communities in the West Bank that a lot of, you know, tourists would never see, and a lot of people who visited the West Bank would never come in contact with. So at the same time, I was working as a volunteer with Voice of Witness, which is an imprint of McSweeney's. And Voice of Witness just does these books of oral history narratives from around the globe that focus on ongoing human rights crises. So at the time, I was just doing whatever I could for them, just because my background is in interviewing. And I really wanted to just get involved with people who were using skills that I had to do important work. So I was doing whatever I could for them. And basically, they invited us to submit a proposal, knowing that, you know, my longtime writing partner was working in the West Bank. So that's how the book kind of took shape early on. It took, you know, many years, but this was back in 2010. So the book took about 4.5 years to come out.
It was really great to see that you actually raised some of the funds through Kickstarter. Mm. And perhaps it might be a future of the independent journalism or the reality of independent journalism. Many of the great journalists, like my favorite John Pilger, for example, crowdfunded their movies. Which, can you talk about independent journalism and also the challenges of funding projects like yours? Expect them, you know, some of the funding came from the Voice of Witness, but
mm-hmm. Yeah, so Voice of Witness is a, you know, it's a small nonprofit, but they do these amazing books from around the globe. So they have books from domestically that focus on women in prison, undocumented immigrants, post 9/11 injustice, and post Katrina New Orleans. And then they have books from Burma and Sudan and Zimbabwe and Colombia. And so I believe our book is the 13th book in the collection. And they all have pretty much the same format, which is a collection of oral history narratives from these places or focused on these issues. But, you know, it's a small nonprofit. It's a small imprint. And, you know, they fight the same battles that I think all small nonprofits do, which is, you know, raising the money to do the work they want to do. And so when we initially submitted our proposal in 2010, they said, you know, we like this and this is something we could get behind. But really what it came down to was the fact that they didn't know us. You know, they didn't really know us and weren't prepared to kind of get behind these two young journalists that they didn't know. And so they kind of told us, you know, we like this, but we won't have money for it for 3 years till 2013. And Kate and I really wanted to take advantage of the connections that she was making over there at the time. And so we decided Kickstarter would be a good idea, you know, to get the initial research funded. And it's a lot of work, you know, and I think a lot of journalists are turning to that crowdfunding model and finding how much work it really is. But it can be amazingly rewarding as well if you're successful, which we were fortunate to be successful. We raised enough money to fund the first 6 months of research over there and kind of get our proposal to that next level for Voice of Witness, so they could see that we were serious about this and they could see the quality of work that we would be bringing them if we were to do this book with them. And so, you know, the funny part of that story is it turns out that they were kind of just tacitly rejecting us with that promise of money 3 years down the road. And I was just too dumb to know that. And so us going to Kickstarter was kind of just ignorant in a certain way, but it turned out to be great because it turned out to really get the book off the ground and show Voice of Witness that we were serious enough to go forward. And, you know, from the initial proposal to when we actually signed with Voice of Witness was 2.5 years. So it was 2.5 years of doing this with no backing, with no promises of this being a book. You know, we did Kickstarter with no promises of this actually being a book. And we decided, you know, even if we don't ever get signed, we'll put something out. You know, we'll self-publish, we'll do something so that we fulfill the promises to our Kickstarter backers. You know, and lucky for us that, you know, our Kickstarter backers were amazingly supportive along the way. They funded us in 2010 and the book came out in late 2014. So they waited 4 years for their rewards, you know, and we think we gave them what they paid for, you know, eventually.
So let's go to the book itself. So there are 16 stories that are included in the book, and my understanding, you spoke to many people. There are hours of interviews, and can you talk about the stories and storytellers themselves, and perhaps you want to share some of your favorite stories or storytellers?
Yeah. So we, in total, we talked to probably more than 70 some odd people over the 4 years. And the 16 narrators in the book are people that we went back and back and back and talked to over and over and over to get what we were looking for, which is kind of a novelistic level of detail to these personal narratives that are in the book. And that's what Voice of Witness is looking to do in all their books. And so that was the level we needed to rise to for our book as well, that very personal, very intimate way of storytelling from people. So there's 16 narrators in the book. Five of them come from Gaza, and the rest are located in the West Bank. We tried to get a mix of people, but we didn't have like a checklist that we were looking to. We didn't want it to be that superficial, really. So a lot of it was just very organic. Who were the people whose stories covered a lot of bases around human rights in the West Bank and Gaza, and the ways in which human rights are kind of interwoven with daily life? We very much wanted to capture that kind of daily life element in the West Bank and Gaza, which we don't really get to hear a lot in Western media. So
there's a certain set of cliches and
yeah, there's cliches that we get. You know, violence makes the headlines a lot of times, but we don't often get to hear who the people are that are impacted by those headlines. And so we really want to give some context to our readers of who the people are when they read the news stories or hear the news stories that make the headlines, who the people are behind those. And, you know, Palestinians are always kind of flattened into these stereotypes, which is a terrorist or a victim. And it's so much more complicated than that and so much more real and human than that. And so that's what we were looking to give our audience and our readers is a glimpse into life, like real life in occupied territories. So our 16 narrators, we think we were able to accomplish that. Some of these people we talked to, you know, more than a dozen times for hours at a time. So there's a lot of material that we collected from these people, and we're able to capture some real depth and intimacy in their stories. There's also two Israeli narrators in the book. One is a security administrator for a settlement in the West Bank, and one is an Israeli kind of pro-Palestinian activist. And we included them to kind of show that, you know, life in the occupied territories is incredibly diverse and complicated. You know, these people certainly don't speak for all Israelis, not all Israeli settlers, not all Israeli activists, but they do show that there's a multitude of people in the West Bank, and they all impact life there, and they all are living, you know, real human drama there and real human life.
There is this trend to portray Israel and Palestine as two equal two equal sides.
Equal powers.
Yes, of a conflict, which is, and the reality, maybe something you can talk about, is very different. I mean, on one hand, we have Israel that has air force bigger than, and it's the fourth largest military in the world. So, and on the other hand, we have a Palestine, which, you know, once again, you said violence makes headlines. You know, we all hear about Hamas firing rockets. But can you just paint us a little picture of what the life in Gaza and West Bank is, as you witnessed it, as, you know, as you're an American journalist?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things you brought up, and one is the kind of need in journalism to show both sides, right? And a lot of times that can get kind of an unequal power balance can get shown, given equal time and equal weight, and people can get a sense that there are equal power systems fighting each other. And that's not really the case over there at all. But, you know, life in Gaza and the West Bank is incredibly diverse and complicated and vibrant in so many ways. And that's another thing we want to capture in the book, is that, you know, to challenge that perception that a lot of people have in the U.S. and in the West, that Palestine is this dark place and it's full of violence and it's dangerous and all that. And we really want to show that there's a vibrant life there, because that's the truth and that's what we want to capture. You know, amidst all the human rights violations that happen on a daily basis to people as they're just trying to go to school or, you know, go to work or just raise their family, you know, people are happy and they're laughing and there's a real dark sense of humor that exists there and keeps people going. And in Gaza, you know, Gaza was devastated by 50 days of bombing this summer. But, you know, in Gaza, there's also the seaside. You know, it's a very Mediterranean place. And that's not something that I had ever seen before I went there. And so that was surprising to me. And that's something we wanted to show as well, is that, you know, it's not just bombs and destruction. And, you know, this was obviously, we went in 2013 to Gaza and were able to cross into Gaza through Egypt. So we got a glimpse of things before the devastation this summer. And so I don't want to undermine the fact that Gaza was absolutely devastated from the 50 days of bombing. If you look at the pictures from the Shujia neighborhood, it's haunting what's happened. But amidst that, are people still, you know, trying to live? You know, Gaza was flooded. I believe that the Israeli military opened up some dams within the last couple of weeks in Gaza and flooded parts of Gaza. And it's bitterly cold there in the winter. So people are certainly struggling and dealing with issues that would challenge anyone in their way of life and you know, living an abundant life. But amidst that, there are people who, you know, are trying and really struggling to live that abundant life. And that's something we try to capture in the book, like I said, how people deal with those kind of interwoven human rights violations amidst their daily life.
So where do we take this? Where do we take our feelings? And because the response would be, you know, and response is to, you know, people who really pay attention to what's going on in Palestine and Israel, is people want to make a difference. And for us, for, you know, American people, it probably would mean to put certain pressures in our government and encourage it to change its policies toward Israel, because I find it's very hurtful for American people, those policies of U.S. policies toward Israel.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is a question I've been getting asked more and more now that the book's been out for a few months and people have read it. You know, people are asking, like, what can we do? You know, I think education is paramount in this situation. And so that's, you know, the book can play a big part in that, is learning what's actually going on. And I think, you know, change can happen individually and on a small scale, just in your friend circles and in your community. Talking about it and sharing the stories and sharing what you've learned and really engaging. Or it can happen on a much larger level of taking action with the policymakers and the people that, you know, supposedly represent you or your community, talking to them and, you know, getting as loud as you possibly can with them to implement the change that you feel personally is important. You know, I'm not here to tell people what to think or, you know, what action they should take. But, you know, I'm all for people taking action that they feel is necessary. And, you know, the book is here, like I said, to give context to the stories that we hear in the news so that we can have more of a human connection with people. A lot of times what happens with Palestinians is they kind of get othered, you know, in the news. And that's something that we were challenging with this book, that kind of quote unquote otherness and humanizing that otherness, if you will, so that when people read or hear about Palestine and some of the headlines that come out of Palestine, you know, they can have a connection to the people who are there, the women and the men and the kids who these, you know, headlines really impact. So, you know, you can take it, like I said, from anything from, you know, talking to your community and reading up. If Kate were here, I think she'd tell you, you know, the best thing you can do is go there and experience it for yourself and see for yourself what life is like on the ground in the West Bank. You know, people have this vision of the West Bank as being this really dangerous place, and it's just not the case. You know, the West Bank is really welcoming to foreigners. And, you know, Americans are always worried, you know, in the Middle East, it's so dangerous. Everybody hates Americans. And, you know, I'll tell you straight up, in the West Bank, it's people are really good about separating Americans from the American government. And so it's a safe place to travel. You know, it's full of headaches and travel difficulties as much as anywhere else in the world. But it's a really hospitable place in so many ways. And I think